Welcome everyone to the Pop Culture Podcast by Fantastic Geek. My name is Matt, and joining me, as always, is Pete. Hello, Pete.
Hello, Matt. Hello, everybody here today to bring you our Aquaman review. And Matt, it's out now for everybody, and numbers are pouring in. In fact, there's a great belief it is going to defeat Mary Poppins Returns. Who saw that coming? And it got an even earlier start than that.
It did. That preview, exclusive to Amazon Prime owners. Note to self, I need to make a change to my Amazon Prime account, but that's unrelated to this, Pete. And we got that early view. And even looking at the numbers for Friday, asterisk, it did $28 million versus Bumblebee's $8.5 million and Mary Poppins' $6.7 million. Now, that Aquaman Friday does include the Thursday night previews, as well as the Saturday night 1-7 p.m. show that was nationwide. I mean, it was obviously multiple shows across the country, but it was just kind of the one slot, so there's a theoretical max there. But, I mean, it's doing very, very, very well, and I think we're going to figure out deservedly so.
This is an upset, I would certainly have to say. Bumblebee has come on strong in terms of word of mouth, but I don't know how in the world Mary Poppins Returns is third on that list. I mean, that has been something that people have been looking to since whenever it was announced, and by all accounts has been very, very strongly reviewed. I mean, geez, there is Oscar buzz for that film, and Aquaman has topped all three of those. It's going to be interesting to see, too, what kind of legs it has in terms of staying power. But I was actually at the library the other day. My phone rings. It's my father-in-law. Hey, Pete, Aquaman, did you see it? Like, yeah, I saw it Saturday, December 15th in the free thing, in the early preview for Amazon. He's like, oh, it was great. He wasn't even aware there were two other Aquaman appearances in previous films. So, you know, part of it is a little bit of that in the general film going public. But as a film here, as DC's first full movie done after Wonder Woman, you have to remember that Justice League was shooting when that film came out. It follows successfully in her footsteps by keeping it light. And I think as we're looking at all three of those films, what is the general consensus in tone, Matt? It is lightness.
And I think that's okay. I mean, you look at some of the baggage, quote unquote, or how about this way? You look at some of the character history, say, of Superman, which in addition to him as a fully fledged character needing to stand up as this metaphor for truth, justice, and the American way, whatever the American way is in these shifting times, whether it's in the last year or 5 or 10 or 20 or 50. But then you say, oh, well, him coming here, Kal-El coming here, it's a metaphor for immigration. Timely indeed, you know, let alone kind of Eastern European or Eastern European Jewish immigration and all of that. How do we fit all that into a movie? Or Batman, all the pathos, the sadness, losing parents, gun violence. Oh, it's all the more timely. Got to work that in, got to work that in. Aquaman seemingly sets the bar lower by saying, we're going to have a fun underwater movie in space or with space stuff and with Tron stuff and with sci-fi stuff and with action stuff. And along the way also tells a story, perhaps even more effectively than the recent outings for Superman and Batman, also tells a story about the importance of ecological conservation, about the notion of only the pure people can lead, about the notion of letting other kinds of people in over the wall. I mean,
seawall, Matt. Let's be fair.
That's true. It's a wall in the sea, so it's completely different.
It is, and no Atlantis government shutdown had it built.
That is true as well. Also, the villain in this movie, a blonde-haired, weird-haired guy who only wants a certain kind of people to lead. But again, the point is, they kind of, they don't aim for it to be, let's say, The Dark Knight, which maybe is the gold standard when it comes to things, or in my mind, X2. They don't aim to consciously be this, you know, Batman, this is a Batman film that's going to explore the war on terror versus the liberties we give up, or X2, we're going to explore what it's like to come out to family members and this and that, the other. This just kind of says, we're going to tell you a story about a guy who wants to get to his kingdom, which already is laced with Christ-like story aspects to it, King Arthur aspects to it, and you kind of let it stand up as its own thing, and you find those metaphors, you don't need to push them through.
Yeah, and when you look at the colossal missteps that have been made in this DC extended universe to this point, rushing to the team-up movie in movie two, the overwhelming darkness of Batman v Superman, Dawn of Justice. I mean, come on, Batman beating the crap out of a tire in a montage. And then the neutered thing that was Justice League in response to Batman v Superman. Oh, you don't like the dark? Hey, look, we got jokes now. And then the unfortunate tragedy that happened with the Snyders in post-production, where their daughter had committed suicide and they worked for a month on the film before the studio came in and said, hey, you guys have gone through a terrible thing. We're going to take over. Look, we have Joss Whedon over here. He's going to jump in. Okay. And thankfully, Wonder Woman has been this ray of light to this point, and now we have Aquaman 2.2. And Matt, what would you have thought if I traveled back in time 10 years to you now? Dark Knight has just come out. Little movie called Iron Man has just come out. And I said to you, Matt, in 10 years, you are going to watch an Aquaman movie that is better than a movie that has Batman fighting Superman. Oh, and a movie that has Batman, Superman, Wonder Woman, Aquaman, Cyborg, and the Flash in it. What would you have told me?
I mean, 10 years ago, it sounds ridiculous. And the one kind of transformation here that I think that we can see in this comic book movie genre, it's not that light and fun is the way to go versus dark and serious. It's that you need to be honest to these characters. I know that there are not a lot of Aquaman fans out there the way, you know, there's Batman fans, Superman, even, you know, or a bit more recently, Iron Man, Thor, you know, etc., all the way down the line.
But there Aquaman are going has, to be now.
Yeah. But they nonetheless, like, I'll be completely honest, Pete, we're sitting there in the movie. I know his name is Arthur Curry. I've known that for forever as growing up DC reader. And at a certain point, they're talking about the King of Atlantis. And I was like, huh, King Arthur. Okay. I was like, I feel silly for not having figured that one out before. But honestly, the character in the comics has been so bland always, or so on the periphery, that it kind of was never like, you know, or maybe it was just, you know, 6-7-year-old me didn't see it, and then the error was baked in. But again, the point is, just be honest to the character. And then when you start to pull back and say, hey, the sea has all these realms, I don't know if that's from the comics or whatever, but it does make sense, because then you get to do these people and those people. And then all of a sudden you realize, oh my goodness, this is exploring a brand new planet, which is the underwater of Earth. Be honest to that. Don't sit and go, we're going to make a movie that needs to check all these boxes and needs to set up the team up or needs to deal with the after effects of the team up. Just be honest to the character. There's a reason why Aquaman has been around for all these years. Same with any of the others. You find the truth in there. You modify it a bit for the modern audience, and it works.
Yeah. And within that formula, smartly not doing a straight origin story after having introduced the character in 2016, you know, one of the better points, one of the better characters in Justice League, and here giving him his own film and giving us the backstory and fleshing that out, really, really helping its case.
Though not going to all that trouble to say, let's do the straight origin story, which is an interesting trend to look at.
Yeah.
And I don't know if it's just a result of so many comic book movies out now. And, you know, side note, I think there's the fear of, oh, who's going to be the one to kill the golden goose? Well, no, it's not that we're in a weirdo kind of trend, you know, like 80s neon or something like that. These are compelling stories. Hopefully none of them does break the golden goose, but it's interesting that we're in this phase where we're not telling the origin story anymore. I don't know if that's just a product of not a trend, just kind of unrelated points, like, hey, the third Spider-Man movie in 10 years with a new guy, or with the third guy, or what, let's not do an origin story there, and so on and so forth. But
oh, I think the lack of a straight situation in terms of the origin is absolutely a factor of a crowded marketplace. I mean, you look at all the different superhero movies that are out there, and they've needed to become their own thing. This, apart from the fact that he is already existing in a larger universe, it would be redundant to go, and here we have a boy and he learns to swim with this guy. I mean, to give you the scenes the way they do, it was, again, the word I keep coming back is smartly written.
I was recently rewatching Black Panther, and I know there's been some discussion, oh, they rip off the format. Well, first of all, this was well in production before anybody in the Warner Brothers DC world would have seen a rough cut of Black Panther, let alone the theatrical release. But I think it's a movie that discovers, just as Black Panther did, discovers some narrative ways to tell some of those things from the past, whether it's origin related or related to the plot of this particular movie. It figures out ways to do it, which, again, it might seem like, oh, here's my YouTube video showing how it ripped it off because it's DC versus Marvel. It's not DC versus Marvel. This is King Arthur meets Jesus meets underwater meets Tron meets Star Wars. It's been through so many hands that it just feels familiar. And if you want to go Star Wars here with a thousand faces or whatever it is, it's following some familiar tropes. And that's part of what makes it okay.
Absolutely. And by the time we examine this prologue here, and you get an actress like Nicole Kidman with Tamora Morrison and pulling you straight into that story, not even hinging it upon Momoa and everything that's been brought there, both in terms of his positive and negative baggage. They pull you into an authentic and interesting story. There's no tire assaults here.
All tires are free in this movie. I think in that prologue portion, to my eyes, it appeared like both Nicole Kidman and Tamora Morrison were wearing prosthetics to de-age them versus kind of the whole computer version that stuff on the Disney end will do. I think it works. Now, I think Disney has gotten its technology to a point where it looks flawless, and maybe some of this, particularly when we return to flashback stuff midpoint of the movie, some of it did look a little plasticky, but it also felt like Nicole Kidman was driving her performance, Tamora Morrison was driving his performance underneath that latex in a way that not every digital character has, or that digital de-aging, regardless of whether you want to go as far back as Tron, or as far back even further as X3, or even a bit more recently with Michael Douglas and Ant-Man, you know, in the original.
Or how about Civil War with Downey Jr.? I mean,
I felt that one was pretty good. That was the first time where it was
very
like
good, very good. But I think we've seen the gamut, and I think, you know, whether it's we don't hire out that you know, special effects lab that works with that comic universe, or they choose to not. Go.
Or gee whiz, they're booked and they can't help you out, Warner Brothers. Right. Oh, it's Industrial Light and Magic, owned by Lucasfilm, owned by Disney. Oops.
Yep. But, you know, to make it a choice in terms of makeup, particularly with Tamora Morrison with the hair, to the point where I'm saying to you in the theater, wait, is that Jango Fett? That is Tamora Morrison, right? And then obviously in the current day scenes, you can tell it's the actor, the age, the weathered nature of his handsome face. But yeah, and then when you look at Momoa and what he's gone through, you know, the decision to make Aquaman this rugged character, you know, beer swilling, catchphrase spewing guy, as opposed to Caucasian who talks to fish, was again an absolute win of a decision.
Jason Momoa is definitely appreciated by kind of the comic book geek Comic-Con fan community. Obviously, a large part of that is Game of Thrones. You referenced him getting over some comments in the past. He, of course, had been a little flippant, certainly prior to the Me Too movement, yeah, a little flippant with his Game of Thrones character, you know, being okay with rape and things like that. I think Momoa and his people recognized, walk that back early, you know, as soon as it kind of became a, I don't want to underplay it, but no, I think that he said it in one kind of mindset where those jokes were not to be taken too seriously. And then when kind of people drew attention to it after the fact, it was okay, time to walk it back, time to put it in context, time to own up to it, time to make it go away.
Yeah, it was a 6-year comment by the time Me Too was moving in earnest last year when the comment resurfaced. And it doesn't hurt that he is beloved on the convention circuit for his willingness, his gameness to do whatever in photo opportunities and just be a generally sweet guy, as opposed to someone who might put on airs and not do that. And oh, they're accused of being an absolute monster, and all of their scenes in a movie that will vie for awards are redone by another actor in 11 days and earn him an Oscar nomination.
So yeah, nice to see that everyone is still fine with Jason Momoa. Again, I'm not trying to say what he said was okay. Just I think
it wasn't.
He properly contextualized it.
He's acknowledged as much. Let's compare that, Matt, to Amber Heard.
Pete, I must confess, prior to Amber Heard and some of her time in the unfortunate end of the spotlight and some of the interactions with Johnny Depp, I was not super familiar with her. Certainly she has become somebody who, you know, she kind of took some of the money post Johnny Depp, dedicated it to, I believe, a women's group in Los Angeles. And she is solid in this movie. Yeah. She's a great presence on the screen. I will mention as a tangent, Pete, there were a couple of scenes, particularly in the desert, when it's just Jason Momoa with Amber Heard, where it's like, who is the best actor in the bunch? I really don't know, because they're both kind of running through lines here.
Yeah.
That said, are we here to see, you know, are we here to see high drama? Maybe not. She's a fun presence. He's a fun presence. And she does a great job as this multifaceted character of Mira.
Yeah, I mean, we talk about Me Too and, you know, what's been unfortunate for Amber Heard that she's spoken out in the press tour here for Aquaman. She lost roles because of the whole Johnny Depp thing, who, you know, though his influence is waning in Hollywood, this is somebody who's had enough reach to be able to blow, what is it, $700 million or some obscene sum that has been pointed to. And with the accusation there of abuse from him. But this is going to be a breakout that's going to earn her more roles, and rightly so. We got that glimpse of her as Mira in the Justice League film. But again, you're evaluating that film like, all right, DC's got to try to, you know, bring me back. They had Wonder Woman, but, you know, even a blind squirrel sometimes. Here now they've shown they can do it twice. And, you know, their hope is going to be, with everything that's gone on with Affleck, with the stuff that's swirling about Cavill, whether or not he will stay in the Superman role. And again, where he is contractually, no one's quite sure. But at least thank goodness, Matt, they have a Wonder Woman. The Wonder Woman movie is on deck next. We have an Aquaman here. Thankfully, you have that Flashpoint Flash storyline out there that might be able to reset. And oh, look, hey, it's Jake Gyllenhaal is really Batman. That Ben Affleck thing, that was all a bad memory.
Shazam too, don't forget. I mean,
Shazam, thank you, thank
just
you.
As fun, yeah.
Which but you don't want to trust the trailers the way you didn't want to trust the trailers for Aquaman. And even Matt, we had heard through back channels this thing's a mess, and there are issues with this film, don't get me wrong. This middle act you're pointing to is, you know, a bad video game side quest, you know, lost in the desert. I've seen somebody compare it to, you know, a bad Hepburn and Tracy film in the middle, and there are elements of that. But bookended all around, it is very, very watchable stuff that is going to help to build the resumes of these two actors.
Moving on here, we have Willem Dafoe, who it's like I had heard him announced for it, and then I forgot about it, probably because it's like, no, don't hurt me anymore, DC. But he's in there as Volko, as the counselor to the leader of Atlantis, and
I think you're searching for Obi-Wan Kenobi. He's in there as Obi-Wan Kenobi.
He is, and darn it, Pete! Thank goodness he teaches young Aquaman something in the first act, the flashback portion. You know, the spinny trident thing. Which darn if that doesn't come and help Aquaman in the final battle. You know. Again, I think there's structure to this movie that's not meant to be Christopher Nolan-esque in its, who is it? Is it a twin? Is it a triplet? Is it a copy machine? It's like, no, he's like man at arms there to serve the kingdom. And usually the kingdom is best served by helping out the guy in the crown, but sometimes it's maybe helping out the guy who could also be in the crown.
I was slightly concerned after the scene in which the hijacked submarine, breaks up the underwater intrigue meeting, that he was in on the plot and that was going to be the big twist, that he's the manipulator behind the throne and everything. And thankfully they didn't, you know, do that for the sake of trying to overthink the viewer. And his presence there really, really welcome the aging, what they did there and the flashbacks, completely believable. I think that makes it a better film. And this after a really good introduction of Black Manta and his storyline, the motivation with his father. And, I keep coming back to these Star Wars, for me, universal metaphors. If Volko is Obi-Wan, what they did with Black Manta, they Boba Fetted him on up. And, you never get too much. And obviously we've set him up for the sequel, but they keep it, you know, that you want more, and they absolutely nailed the design.
Yahya Abdul-Mateen II is great as Black Manta, and in that opening scene where, you know, he and his father are revealed to be pirates and they're on the Russian sub and all that, the one complaint that I had while watching that scene was, I kind of feel sympathetic for this Black Manta and his dad, because Aquaman seems to be, I know it's a comic book movie, but he's throwing metal doors at people and there's a nice clung and they fall down, but that should smush a man's head clear off. turns out it was actually the story acting in service of itself, because you're kind of meant, I think you're meant to be like, yeah, Aquaman saved the day, but I feel bad for those two guys over there, one of which is gonna get all blowed up there. That's the point, Pete. James Wan snuck in some carrots with our mashed potatoes here. It all works together.
Yeah, what a year for African American or just Black in terms of these villains and their backstories and the pathos there that makes us, whether it's Killmonger and Michael B. Jordan, okay, whether it's Black Manta here, see their motivation and not question, this guy is bad just because he is bad. The circumstances of Arthur refusing to help his father, something he voices regret about later, that's part of his journey being key to Black Manta's journey, I think, you know, really, really well done.
The story eventually does take us to Atlantis. And again, I feel like the story, cribbing from the best sources or the most universal sources, it's this really great visual presentation. We have moments where it's like, you know, underwater movies that you've seen before, Finding Nemo, Little Mermaid, etc. Yeah, there's moments where they're in their aqua spaceship, flying in their aqua space in order to get to the aqua space station and the space aqua gate. But it makes this really foreign world feel familiar.
It does. And whether it's elements of the design, all the various sea lifes represented in terms of, you know, you've got your crustaceans, you've got your mollusks, you've got the seahorse people, the really strange mutant sea people, the savages. What were they again? The ones in the trench, you know, eminently watchable, and the design as strong to that. I mean, I think of the sea stormtrooper suits, whether they're the white ones or the red that are kind of crustacean in nature and everything there, and the various elements of them, you know, really, really pop on the screen.
We, of course, eventually get introduced to Orm, the future Ocean Master, played by Patrick Wilson. He of Fargo Season 2 fame. Was that Season 3? Fargo
Season 2.
Fargo Season 2 fame. And, of course, as Night Owl in the Watchmen movie that continues to get worse over time, though I haven't seen the 8-hour director's cut with extra slow motion. But he's great in it, too. Again, something oddly familiar about him having almost unnatural blonde hair and being out there to want to be the guy in charge and make sure that, you know, those people don't try and take over. But enough about that, Pete. Worth mentioning, he is 6 years younger than Nicole Kidman, who plays his mother. So I guess things work a little differently down there under the sea.
Thankfully, they do. And yeah, whether it's the 6-year difference in age between Patrick Wilson and his on-screen mom, you know, that is what it is. And they're playing fictional universe characters, so the mind doesn't scrutinize it the way we would if, you know, they're in a you know, period drama, a straight up dramatic presentation, and be like, well, wait, no, what? This guy, and this is his mom, and this is his age, and this is her age. I think it's something that obviously they were aware of, and you have the willing suspension of disbelief because of this type of project. And then, you know, a guy like Dolph Lundgren shows up and, you know, chews up the scenery. I mean, Matt, what a year he's had with Creed 2. And now with an Aquaman movie, you know, Momoa, Heard, we're seeing so much of Dolph Lundgren here 30 some odd years later. What the heck?
And I know, you know, some of the catty reviews have been like, oh, you could see Dolph Lundgren in a red wig. All right. Well, first of all, he's meant to be Mira's father. Mira has red hair. So, yeah, they plunk this guy in a red wig. You see Nerys in a red wig with red beard. Like, I don't know what to tell you. He's great in it. Worth keeping in mind, you know, his performance is solid. This, of course, somebody who, to me, is central, not for Rocky, although that's probably what he's most famous for, but central as He-Man in the Masters of the Universe right. film. One of the two things that make that movie's heart shine through despite the problems along the way. Also, just as a quick tangent, worth remembering that Dolph Lundgren has a master's in chemical engineering. Super bright guy. Yeah. Went to MIT before he left MIT. Left doctoral studies at MIT in order to pursue this successful career in acting and whatnot. And he's just a great presence on screen. Not in it a ton, but I'd rather have him versus like British guy of a certain age who maybe I saw in Downton Abbey.
But whereas, Matt, Batman v Superman and Justice League, the latter, much more than the former, had design not done as well as these, it's that they understand these characters. And even then, the ones that aren't fully fleshed out in terms, yes, there is comic backstory and history there. What is presented on screen, they get the character. So when you come back to the element of design and you have, you know, Deep Sea Tron with, you know, Daft Punk-esque techno music, you don't cry rip off, you embrace it. When we talk about an octopus playing drums at the Ring of Fire challenge scene here, you go with it as opposed to, you know, the octopus beating the crap out of tires along with Batman to make a kryptonite spear that later Batman and Superman and the octopus will all have a mother named Martha.
Isn't that the way it is with octopi, their mothers with Martha and whatnot? But I mean, you're right. It's about character stuff. It's about the wacky quest that they're on, which in the middle of the movie becomes go get all the things for the thing in order to decode the thing. Even then, like as much as kind of going to Italy and going to the desert, I think it was a tad too long. I think this is a movie with about 15 minutes too much fat in there, and maybe you take it out of that portion. That said, over the last couple of days, I saw James Wan do a thing on YouTube, I think for Vanity Fair, where he took apart the fight choreography and the you know, from his directorial point of view, that whole fight in Italy. And there's so much going on there that kind of I hadn't fully appreciated, in part because, all right, the talky-talky stuff of let's have Hepburn and Tracy in the desert detracts a bit. This is a fight still in the same portion of the movie, you know, on a different continent, where the energy is up, the energy is through the roof, and you have fun with crab suit guy smashing through walls in this incredibly difficult shot, and the fun shines through.
That sequence is largely well done, and it breaks up the dryness. See what I did there, Matt? The broke-ass Indiana Jones map room through a bottle thing, which broken up at a moment when you don't expect it to happen and pushes you through that sequence forcefully and effectively. While jumping out of the plane and the discussions happening on dunes and falling into a vacant place, like, all right, I get it, deserters, but like you never saw any of the deserters. So they deserted and they died out and it's like never, ever addressed. But by the time Black Manta is kicking the crap out of Aquaman with his face laser goggle thing that's powered by water, you're all in.
And it's just another example of that character stuff pulling through. And I wonder if maybe the movie started to fast forward itself a little bit too, because I think of the time spent to get to the message through the bottle and blah, blah, blah. And at a certain point, you're like, in the portion of the sea where crustaceans are coming up, and then they're under with the crustaceans and have the flare, and then really quick get to, wait a minute, Pete, who is that taking off their helmet? Surely it's not the character who presumably died when she left Tamora Morrison in the beginning, and then they hammered home a couple other times, no one goes to the trench without dying. Ergo, I infer without evidence that mom is dead.
But she was murdered off screen. That always is permanent and in no way film code for I will see you in the third act to present necessary information for the hero to complete his quest. Yeah, there were people audibly gasping around us in a, you know, nearly completely filmed theater, which should have indicated to us how well this is going to it is doing. But yeah, people were shocked. And all right, we watch a little bit more of this stuff and are a little bit more keyed into the signs and the signals and the idea that you don't sign a Nicole Kidman and just use her in, you know, those two scenes in the beginning of the film. But yeah, to kind of have her with the variation of the outfits, with the dreads there, kind of to be looking like, you know, the twins in the second Matrix movie, with the white, and to marry it together with that. All right, is it goofy that there's an ocean in the middle of the planet, and, you know, the monster that's down there that they've mentioned three times, that now we know he's got a bypass in order to get the special trident and get back up there and kick the crap out of his brother. We forgive all that because of the roundness of story.
The roundness of story and the tone, like the goofy things that some critics are rightly calling out as goofy. Yeah, they are, but it's done in a way where you're not meant to, you're meant to have a good time. You're not meant to kind of have this, you know, the Dark Knight kind of like, oh man, the Joker represents terrorism in our world, which there is a place for that kind of story. They just chose to not have their cake and eat it too, in terms of, we're going to do that plus have primary color fun. No, we're going to have primary color fun, throw in some old school, you know, like family trouble that people can relate to, a little bit of King Arthur, and that's what leads us to, you know, Aquaman riding the monster, a thinly veiled Kraken, although it's not called Kraken. I wonder if maybe Disney has now taken over the word Kraken. I don't know. But he's riding a giant Kraken to fight the forces of evil, and bad guys move from right to left, and good guys move from left to right, and we have our big CGI climax with the monster that saves the day.
A monster voiced by the former Mary Poppins that has now come out triumphant over the current Mary Poppins. I mean, there's so much going on here, Matt.
There are, and I know there was some discussion like, oh, the monster's out of the blue to save the day. I think probably in the draft of the script, they realized that, which is why they're like, all right, the monster shows up on page 90. Quick, you, get to page 60. Make reference to the thing by name. And you, get to page 30. You mention like, oh, the most powerful creature of the deep is luckily locked away in Atlantis King's secret hideaway that none shall ever go to. Oh, whew, there we go, guys. We worked it in organically.
Yeah.
I don't tell you.
Deus Ex Monstera is a little bit too far, but they had set it up to the point. There's enough of a conflict with it and a moving past, rather than just a, I'm going to beat you and I get the trident. To make it organic enough as a story. Yes, this CGI climax throwdown, very, very similar to others. I'd have to say, of all of the current DC Universe films, it's the best one. You know, that is the one flaw within Wonder Woman, is CGI fight where bad guy yells no and heroine throws tank at him, and things are near incomprehensible. This is better to look at. Yeah, is there a moment where Arthur and Mira, not in the bubble power that she has, but hey, in the middle of this gigantic fight, we're going to have a scene of dialogue where no one attacks us, of all the armies beating the crap out of one another in the ocean here. Oh, and giant monster there too. Yeah, that's a bit much, and you definitely notice it. But to push it forward, to get them fighting on the top there, the rematch between King and would-be usurper, it all makes sense.
Yeah, and it gets to that rematch, because it turned out the big army versus army fight was actually set up for brother versus brother. Only complaint I have in this topside scene, which I'm realizing now might have been fought on a floaty thing on the surface of the water, so you could get the guys like not in harnesses, not in CG. I mean, it's like CG background, but you can get them like actually hitting each other with sticks. But only complaint is Patrick Wilson's Orm has like a CG, his helmet is CG, so when he yells, like it will move a bit, which is just a wacky. Like, I understand it still is Ocean Master because I saw him put on the unique helmet and it's the same color as Ocean Master's outfit the whole time. I could have done without that little extra bit, but it ends up being a good fight. And brother rehabilitated, maybe not rehabilitated, but brother lives to see the end. Will he be back one day? I don't know, Aquaman 2.
If only, Matt, we could continue to build out this DC extended universe where Patrick Wilson, who has played Night Owl 2 in Watchmen, could, like the comics with the DC heroes as they've done with the Watchmen, inhabit the same universe where he plays another character as if they'd ever appear on a screen together and talk to one another. You know, when Night Owl has to go to Atlantis and, you know, go to the go to the brig and attempt to get, you know, forensic evidence for an investigation. I kid, but you know, with what Patrick Wilson brought to this role, and the very simplistic choice would be, well, they have to fight to death. He has to kill his brother. And instead it's made more complicated. It's made more interesting by the fact that Arthur shows forgiveness, that Kidman, oh no, no, wait, he's my son too. And I love you both and the whole thing there. So again, nothing but good choices made here that the audience rightfully recognizes.
Patrick Wilson had a great interview with the Hollywood Reporter in the last couple days where he talked about all the movies that he's done with James Wan. I believe this is the sixth or seventh because
he's done. Oh, I was unaware of that.
Yeah, it's like the Insidious scary movie connected universe he's been in. And literally it was a case like James Wan phoned him up and made the offer. And then when Patrick Wilson like was like, yeah, yes, absolutely, then like mentioned it to his agent and his manager, they're like, well, wait, how many scenes are you in? Where are you in the build cast? What are you this? And he's like, no, James Wan wants me in this movie. While we were on the phone, I Googled Ocean Master. It looks cool. James Wan is not going to let me down.
Good for him.
In fact, the quote was, James Wan's not going to waste my time, and I'm not going to waste his. So, like, if he wants me for this role, it's a Patrick Wilson-sized role, and it's right for Patrick Wilson. So, next, move on.
Yeah, and just to speak briefly about that design, I really dug it. The mask did not bother me in the least. I kind of really appreciated the red of the eyes of the goggles, and then there was a little bit of a classic He-Man, Masters of the Universe, Merman vibe for me that was really nostalgic. But
we got to get James Wan to do Masters of the Universe,
please.
Man.
Please. Well, listen,
perfect.
Can we get James Wan and Patty Jenkins to just completely take over the DCEU at this point? A woman and an Asian man have made, again, this is not an unpredictable thing. They've brought new perspectives to tired, you know, subgenres and made them really compelling. What? Who would have ever thought?
Well, that's just it. Like, they have found these interesting things. Like, I don't know that 6-7 years ago, even with the fame of Game of Thrones, I don't know that Jason Momoa was the first person to come to mind for, you know, blonde-haired, blue-eyed, soft-spoken Aquaman. But the decision gets made for a variety of reasons, and then with it comes another Southeast Asian role for the father and added diversity and so on and so forth. And yeah, put these people in charge. All due respect to Geoff Johns and all those people at Warner Brothers. Time to bring in a new perspective if you want this stuff to continue to work.
Yeah. And who would have thought, Matt, another HBO show that had tainted Aquaman, used it as the butt of a joke in Entourage, and the people that generally are acknowledged as being massive fans of that. I mean, like what you like. I'm just talking about the dude bro, you know, really kind of politically incorrect nature of the people that would point out that that's their thing, you know, actors and, you know, tales of abuse and womanizing and things like that. And, you know, what we get in Aquaman, yeah, we get the not so clean living character, but the one we get behind. And I think that's a really special thing. Give James Wan all the Aquaman, give Patty Jenkins all the Wonder Woman. Really looking forward to Shazam. And if anything, my only other gripe with this was no look at Wonder Woman. You couldn't tip us on one of the post-credit scenes there, you know, hey, here's Diana in, you know, a massive shoulder piece, parachute pant outfit in DC in 1984.
I think that they made the right decision, and here's why. When you look at the worst of the MCU, it's when they're trying to feed the next movie in the one movie.
Yeah.
Now, usually that's not a problem when it's a post-credit scene, particularly if it's after the end of the credits, because you've literally just sat through the end of this story and then the cutesy pat on the head on the way out, then through 9 minutes of, you know, VFX companies and music licensing and all that. So it really feels like the end. You know, however, I think to turn this movie into, oh, be excited about it and also be excited about the next thing because hashtag it's all DC connected. Like, no, the time has come to unconnect these. And I think, too, you also see that a little bit on the Marvel end as well. Yes, there's been scenes that connect things, but, you know, Black Panther mostly stand alone. You need maybe you take a little knowledge from Civil War and then you have the Winter Soldier thing at the end, but mostly stand alone. Same thing, you know, with Ant-Man and the Wasp, largely standalone except for its post-credit thing. Maybe even to a certain degree, you can make the argument for Spider-Man Homecoming, as entrenched as it is with Tony Stark. I think we're moving in this trend where it's not like, oh, look, here's another example of the purple head guy who has a glove for what? And more just tell this story and focus on this story, and that's okay.
Yeah, so to treat us to the credit scene that sets up the sequel with Black Manta rescued and Dr. Stephen Shin here, played by Randall Park, also an Ant-Man and the Wasp this year. Look at what a great year he's had and what that means for representation. You know, the really kind of the Volko mentor role in the comics, Stephen Shin, before he turns into, well, I need to find Atlantis. And they've made him this kind of crackpot conspiracy guy who obviously is going to help out Black Manta. And he should be a returning character alongside for the sequel.
Yeah, I mean, no shame in setting up the sequel in the way it does. I know Dr. Shin appears in the one, maybe two, but you know, he's like on the news kind of scene during the course of the movie. And if it is two scenes, it still is him on the news. You know, no harm, no foul that you're doing those things. Again, I think that the form of the comic book movie as a genre, it's evolved a bit where you don't always need to hit, you know, we talked about origin stories before. You don't always need to hit that in its kind of traditional, you know, Superman the movie, we're going to spend whatever it is, 35, 40 minutes until we actually see Superman in super outfit flying to Metropolis. Same thing here. Okay, everyone lives to fight another day. Black Manta is a great villain. Dr. Shin here can facilitate him in some way. And, you know, announce my Aquaman 2 ASAP.
Yeah, I mean, my father-in-law called again after I couldn't fully take his call, you know, because library, and it wound up being a butt dial. But he's like, yeah, when's the Aquaman sequel coming out? I mean, he's just my father-in-law is in his late 60s. He's just discovered binge watching and watched 39 episodes of Daredevil in like 47 hours. And wants to know when more is coming. So, you know, these are problems in 2018 for someone with as little patience as my beloved father-in-law has. But yeah, there is instantly this anticipation. I am sure after the holiday break here, we're going to start to hear, well, Juan is back and Momoa and Hurd and everybody else, and they will get a plum spot on that schedule moving forward. I mean, what you figure, Shazam next year, Wonder Woman's 2020 now. They've backed that up, I think, smartly rather than rushing to it and building towards that. You'll have, I guess, Aquaman after that. I don't think the Flash is far enough along in terms of what's going on. And, you know, I know those guys they want for the Flash are, you know, busy again after mishandling a major project. And, you know, yeah, that was the whole deal there. But we'll see. There's a light again, Matt, at the end of the tunnel, instead of it being, you know, actually Batman's crawly thing that is going to rip you into pieces.
Well, here's what Wonder Woman and this movie and the look of Shazam and the early reputation of Wonder Woman 1984 all tell. They all tell this notion of have the movie focus on a great story that is great for the movie that it wants to be. Okay, throw in some stuff there for it to be continued or whatever. But, you know, that rush to let's get to Justice League, you don't need to do that. Make a great Aquaman movie. And you know what? I'll sit through a pretty good Aquaman story in Justice League 2 or whatever that future is, whatever the future team up might be. I'll enjoy it if I really, really enjoy Aquaman from the preceding two standalone Aquaman movies or whatever it might be. With that, Pete, let's get to some feedback that other people would like to share regarding this movie. We got a tweet from at ZP International who said of the film, I enjoyed it. The de-aging process on Nicole looked great. The story, Ocean, flowed nicely. Some nice little one-liners. A bit more violent in a superhero film than most, in my opinion, but I do give it an A-.
It's almost like ZP has already listened to this podcast.
I can assure you that ZP International has not.
To the Facebook, Matt, where Mary Kirk and her clan were absolutely frothing, see what I did there, to get at Aquaman for the Prime preview last week. She was even taking pictures of the screen. I mean, Matt, when you and I were in the movie theater, we watched a woman attempt to film the post-credit sequence until, you know, I burned a hole in the back of her head with my eye lasers. But the verdict from Mary, that this was tons of fun, totally worth seeing in the theater. And it's now going to be the number one film this weekend, topping Bumblebee, which she's also very high on, and Mary Poppins, which she was high on as well. I'm pretty sure, Matt, as Mary goes, so goes the film going public.
I will mention, Pete, this is the first time you and I have done one of these Prime early preview things. I don't know that there's been many beyond this and Jumanji last year. I feel like it's a win-win thing, and I feel like Mary's experience helps hammer that home. Like, we kind of felt special standing in the special line, which really was no more special than any other line to get into a theater. But there was a special thing that said Prime members only for Aquaman. So I think we gave an impartial view, and I'm sure Mary enjoyed it as much as she would have in any showing. But as a product to be put out into the marketplace, I think you're going to have a slightly more rapt audience to be like, yeah, I have a special thing that I pay for that anybody could pay for that got me into this movie. And it was neat to see it a little early. It really was.
Yeah, and there were people clamoring while we were on the line, like, oh, I'm going to this other movie. What is this for? And there was a little sign there, and people were like, oh, that's out already? And, you know, there was some buzz.
For you, commoner, sorry.
Yeah, wow.
We are from Atlantis. You are from the surface.
Get out of here, you trenches. yeah, I mean, there was this buzz, and look where we are now in terms of the results. So I think it's fair to say we're going to see some more Amazon Prime things. I'll throw my money right on the table now, Matt. Though it's DC and Amazon aligning here. Last year it was Jumanji and Amazon Maybe like Disney, and if they were to ever have a Disney streamer, and if you're a customer, you could see Star Wars Episode 9 6 weeks early. Take my money. I pay for your service, and you have a one-off showing of Episode 9 at an advanced date that I've got to be a member to. Sign me up right now, sight unseen on that service.
Kanji Club. Well, Pete, we see in Aquaman the use of some gold doubloons there helping James Wan's producing partner, Lee Wan-Eel, the pilot, get them to the desert. Pete, we would be in a desert without those who send their own doubloons, their own help through patreon.com/fantasticgeek.
Absolutely. At a time of year when the bill comes due, when some technology might need to be replaced, all of our contributors here who get access to exclusive podcast content come through even more for us. So you cannot imagine how much you help us in being able to produce this content. This is the fourth straight year Fantastic Geek has continued to top itself in terms of sheer amount of content, where well over 150 podcasts for the year are going to come in just about 160, if not just under that, and could not do it without our patrons.
Indeed, they are our team of CGI army fighting alongside with us, and they make it all possible. Pete, how can people be in touch with you to talk Aquaman, to talk MCU, to talk future geeky things for 2019 that we can't talk about yet, but they might want to talk about?
You can find me on Twitter at Peter, PIETERJKETELAR, KETELAAR, 10,257 followers. Can't be wrong.
And while I'm personally on Twitter as Looking Back Lost, do be in touch with the podcast. Comment on FantasticGeek.com. Check us out on Twitter, Instagram, and Gmail, where we are FantasticGeek as well. But wait, Pete, there's more.
Facebook.com/FantasticGeek with the PH, all one word, like it today.
Well, Pete, for those listening on the Pop Culture Podcast feed, we have plenty of goodies ahead, including more runaways and some holiday treats as the week goes on. With that, Pete, I will say glub, 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 which is underwater speak for adios to all our listeners, and give you the final word.
Something, something, trident.